Okay, I'm going to take my mask off now while I give the talk. Tell me that's allowed. And also, I feel incredibly healthy, roaring to go. But anyway, welcome everybody to tonight's talk. When I give a talk to an empty hall, it always does feel a little bit different for the reason that when I usually give talks, I try and pick up on the energy of the people who are sitting in front of me, trying to let my mind become peaceful enough so that I can almost like tune in to what you need and what works for you. But for tonight, the mind is just dwelling on sometimes some people get very disappointed when life doesn't go in the way they expected it to. We all make plans. We always have expectations. But maybe tonight will be about planning and how that so often that we plan in such a way which doesn't make life easier for us, which causes us problems and difficulties. As if the plans have to work, they have to be like this. And a lot of times, if you can make as few plans as you possibly can, and the plans which you do make, to keep them made out of plastic or rubber, like the old plasticine which I used to use as a kid in the primary schools, so they can be bent into anything. In other words, the future is always malleable, can always be changed and bent to something useful. Even in business conferences, which I would speak at now and again, we'd always ask that to be successful, businesses have to adapt very quickly, to be able to change, to take opportunities as they arise. We can't always expect this world to be the same and to just predict how it will be in the future. We always have to have this beautiful idea of being here in this moment, seeing this moment and taking the opportunities as they arise. Some of those anecdotes which I've managed to collect over these years starts off with how Ajahn Chah used to teach me. Because he was a very skillful teacher. He didn't just teach by giving sermons or, you know, talks. Sometimes just by physical life he would tell you and teach you and train you. And one of the things he used to do, and the first time he did it, it really shocked me. You know, together with about two other Western monks, he said, get your bowl, sitting cloth ready, we're going to, you know, a distant monastery for our lunch dana. Of course, I never expected that. He was just told that early in the morning. And so I got my things, and only a few things, obviously, just your bowl and your robe and sitting cloth, and hurriedly put them in your bag, and off we went in a truck to close to the Laotian border. And there we had a dana, very nice food. But then afterwards he took us to a nearby monastery and says, here you're going to stay for 3 or 4 days and I'll pick you back up in about 5 days' time. So, you never said that. And I haven't got even a toothbrush. I haven't got a towel. I haven't got any soap. I haven't got anything. And of course, Ajahn Chah said, well, you'll survive. And so for 3 or 4 days in this remote forest monastery, very close to the Laotian border, you didn't have any toothpaste or toothbrush. You tried to do something, use finger and salt to clean your teeth. You didn't have any soap, you just washed in water. You didn't have any towel, you just have to dry off in the sun. You didn't have so many things like a clock. You just, you know, try to wake up on time or just, now, when the sun rose, all those things, which I didn't even have a spoon, I think, all those things which you thought were essential, you just didn't have. And it taught you. We've got two lessons there. The first lesson was just you can survive if you know how to adapt. You don't have all these ideas, I must have this, it must go like this, I must do it this way. If you pull it all aside, all that must and oughts and shoulds, to me those are always danger words for me. Shoulds and musts and oughts. Because sometimes you just can't do it. And also, put aside all those things which you think you really need, the basic necessities of life. A toothbrush was not the basic necessity of life. You know, you can do something else with your to brush your teeth and keep them clean. So it showed you how little you needed to be comfortable and to survive. And also just how you could adapt. You had a choice. Adapt or complain and suffer. And of course, the reason I tell stories like that is because we just had a lockdown in Perth just this evening, which is why we can't have any people in the hall here. But you can always adapt and do something else. And when I look at the things with lockdown, maybe it's because I'm a monk, but I think, wow, you know, so much more peace and freedom over the weekend. Don't have to talk to people. even like today, before we came here, we went to such a delicious dana. This is what happens when people invite the monks out to bless their house. And they really put so much effort into making delicious food for the monks. And so that people know what I like now, they've had a look and make sure they know what I take and what I don't take and what I eat. So I get so much delicious food these days, like today. Because it's hopeless. And they look at you, and if you don't eat a lot, you know that sometimes they get a bit upset. Well, don't really get upset, they get disappointed. So for the next couple of days, when there's a lockdown, yay, I can actually eat less. Because no one's looking at you, so don't put in psychological pressure on you to please eat a lot, eat a lot, eat a lot. It's like that, you know. Sometimes, sort of on the alms round, even here in Nolamara, we've got lots of heaps of food on the table. And there's, you know, some of it I can take, some of it I won't take. But then I go past somebody's food, and they look at me and said, "My wife cooked that." Oh my goodness, I better take some out of compassion to what they would do to their husband if he didn't force me to put some in my bowl. But, you know, I enjoy stuff like that because it puts a bit of fun into monastic life, but it's impossible to go on a diet. But anyway, just that joy that sort of part of monastic life of being fed too much. It's going to disappear tomorrow, and the next day, because now I can come to Bodhinyana. Yay! Actually, enjoy that. You can always see the different parts of life. Another part of lockdown, obviously. Yay! Lockdown, it just almost like teaches you that it's like a retreat. The whole of Perth is on retreat for the weekend, a weekend retreat. At home, if they only knew how to make use of that time. Make use of that time because I told that story this afternoon at the Dana, and it's one of the most beautiful stories which I've heard and tell. Because this came up so many years ago, but it's still relevant in today's world, incredibly relevant in today's world. There was a story about the little six-year-old son who was waiting for his daddy to come home from work on a Friday evening. When daddy came home late, because he had to do extra work and stuck in the busy traffic, when daddy came home, the child asked him, "Daddy, how much do you earn at work?" "None of your business!" But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn in the office? Look, I told you, there's nothing to do with you. Be quiet, I'm tired. But Daddy, how much money do you... That's it, three times, go to your room. Of course, you can tell how old this story is, because in those days, sending a kid to his room was like punishment. These days, it's giving him full opportunity to get on his iPad or whatever electronic equipment and play play games. But anyway, the kid went up to his room, and the father felt guilty after a little while. You know what it's like when you tell someone off because you're angry, you're upset, you're tired, and the poor little child had done nothing really wrong. So Daddy went up to see the child, and Daddy asked the child, look, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I was tired, I was late, I shouldn't have shouted at you. And look, I don't know why you, my son, wants to know how much I earn at work, but it's $20 an hour in the office. And I have to work very hard for that. Thank you, Daddy, said the son. Now can I please have $10? And the father would usually get angry. He got angry for a second, but then he thought, I've already got angry once when I shouldn't. So the father said, okay, and opened up his wallet and took out a $10 note. And after that, the little son smiled, took the $10 note, said, thank you so much, Daddy. And then the son opened up the little drawer by the side of his bed, and there was coins in there. And he had just about enough to count out another $10 in coins. And together with the $10 note, he handed it to his daddy. Daddy, here's $20. Can I now have 1 hour of your time, please? A kid having to buy time from his parents simply because he realized how much he needed that time. And with that story, I also mentioned I happened to be in Singapore when this occurred. It was in the front pages of the Straits Times. There's one of these young boys, 15, 16, I can't remember exactly how old, committed suicide, threw himself off a balcony in one of the high-rise apartments. And his suicide note said, all I wanted was to spend more time with my mummy and daddy. I don't know about you, but that just hit me very hard when I saw that, and hit so many other people very hard. Little things to solve so many social and emotional problems in our life. Just have time together. It's lockdown here in Perth. What a wonderful opportunity to have time together with your family. Stuck in the house for the weekend. Spend time together, talk to one another, be with one another, enjoy each other's company over the weekend. And you've got good excuses not to go out to this appointment or that appointment. You don't have to go out to sport, you know, a little bit of shopping. You don't have to do that much shopping, it's only 3 days. You don't have to go out to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Stay at home and practice what we teach, which is kindness and being with one another. You know, sometimes you ask yourself, why, when people have the opportunities to have time together, why do we resent that time together? One of the reasons, of course, is people don't know how to relate even to their own mothers or fathers or children. Even though they've lived together for so many years, sometimes a little bit of kindness, of fun and games, of joy, the telling jokes or whatever, even just sitting together telling stories with your family. And that brings to mind 46 years ago when I first went to Thailand and ordained as a monk. I went to stay up in the northeast of Thailand, which that area was very remote, there was no electricity. There's no TVs, there's no entertainment, you know, outside of what you created for yourself. So remember many evenings going into the village, Bungwai village, to do some chanting or some ceremonies. And I liked going into that village in the evening, not to do the ceremonies as much as to see the lifestyle. The lifestyle in these villages, which had been going on for I don't know how many decades, and to see the houses, they're built on wooden stilts, the water buffalo, which was an important part of their life to be able to plow the fields to make rice, were underneath the house, and they all were very close to that particular family. They were like pets more than animals of burden. And upstairs there was, just made out of rough home-sawn wood, there's a big open area, and on the outside of that area, on three sides, were the rooms which different people lived. Because it wasn't just one family there, there was uncles and aunties and grandparents and kids. There's about 18 or 19 people in every house. And I saw them there in the evenings. They weren't going to the house which I was going into to do the chanting. They were just sitting up there in the evening in front of one or two little oil lamps. And the oil lamps were just so simple, homemade. Kerosene in a bucket or something, or in a, not a big bucket, but a small bowl of water, a bowl. And then they used to use the top of toothpaste tubes, you know, which they'd cut off. And through the toothpaste tube, they put some rags, and that would act as the wick. And it was a very smoky light, but imagine them, it enabled them to see one another. In that smoky light, the smoke kept the mosquitoes away in the evening. So it was a very efficient way and very cheap, simple way of creating some light, especially using old rags which they couldn't use to sew into anything anymore. And it was used to burn, to make this light in the evening. And this would be every evening they'd be doing the same. Sitting around in a semicircle, telling stories to one another. You can hear them bursting out laughing sometimes. The sort of laughter which I hadn't seen for years. Just unrestrained, joyous. Some old grandfather had told another joke or old story, which made even the kids just burst out weeping with laughter. But the most important thing, it was done together every evening. The whole family would be together just telling stories, anecdotes. Most of those stories were probably untrue, but that didn't really matter. What was important was the joy, fellowship, kindness and love they had together there, the whole family. When I looked at that, I'm just imagining it right now as I'm telling you, it gave me so much feeling that I'd lost out in my childhood by having things like TVs, having only three people to love in my house, my mum, my dad and my brother. And now seeing just big families sharing their time together every evening, what a beautiful scene that was. I don't know, maybe that's a possibility during lockdown. If you have some family in the house, you're not staying there by yourself, you have some family, just sit down together, talk. Tell a few stories, jokes. You know, that's some of what we do in Bodhinyana Monastery. And that's true, isn't it, Venerable Metaji? We tell some old stories and some jokes and stretch the truth a little bit every now and again. Not in a, to deceive, just to make a, make a good story together. And that beautiful sense of fellowship in our Sangha. A group of people staying together. We try to do that every evening, whenever we can. But now you have that opportunity to talk, and to talk kindly to one another. One of the truths which I've discovered over all these years, you look at a person, I don't care where they come from, what nationality, what race, what religion, what whatever. And just, they love being respected and sharing with some friendship. And that, to respect one another, there is, and I say this with a lot of meaning, to respect your wife, your husband. They're not perfect, but they're trying their best. They're so similar to you. If you can remember how you feel, then that's how your partner feels. Look at your kids, how they feel, that's how you feel. Your parents. Human beings have the same heart. I'm not talking about the physical heart, the emotional heart. We want happiness, we want acceptance. We know we're not perfect, we don't need to be told off. But the thing which we need most of all is to be loved and cared for and valued. And to see that with joy and happiness and a bit of fun and games, doing stupid things together. If you can do things like that, encourage things like that, it creates so much peace and harmony. You've got a wonderful opportunity to do that on this weekend. See if you can come together. You're in lockdown, you can't go out. The delights of the world can't pull you out, except on this, I suppose, on TVs and stuff. I don't know what TVs are there for. They're supposed to entertain you or inform you. They usually just disturb your mind. They take you out. I know one thing about that with every now and again, I look at the news on the internet and see all this stuff about football. They can't understand that, so they have football competitions. Only one team can be happy. And all the other teams in the competition have to be sad. Because they can't win. Even the team which comes second. I remember that because, just for your information, I don't know why this happened to me. It was actually quite helpful. I reckon it was quite useful. When my father moved down from Liverpool to London, he went to live with his brother, my uncle, in the town, a suburb of Fulham. And so that used to be my brother, like our family's football team, go and see Fulham. They always lost. Always kept on losing. And as a young boy, I thought, oh my goodness, why do they keep on losing? But it was actually good for me. So you lost all interest in that after a while. But then you look at the whole thing about things like football or AFL or the Olympic Games. You know, when it's countries playing or like teams playing, you may have a competition of maybe 36 teams or something. Only one team is going to go back happy. 35 teams are going to go back miserable. I know that because the first year I became a monk, the very first year, my local football team started doing well in the FA Cup. If you're English, you know the FA Cup's the biggest thing in the whole world for many people. And even though they weren't doing so well in the other competitions, they kept on beating all these other big teams in the FA Cup. And I get all these letters from my brother in London saying, wow, we've beaten Everton. Wow, we've beaten Manchester United. Wow, we've beaten somebody else. We're now in the quarterfinal. Wow, we've beaten somebody else. We're now in the semifinal. Now we've beaten the current champions. Now we're in the final. I never heard from them again. Because they lost the final. I got from that, the closer you get to success, the more miserable you are afterwards when you lose. It's best to lose early and get it over and done with. But anyhow, if you're just doing it for the fun of the game and winning or losing is not so important, that's really good. But many people don't appreciate that in this world. They always want to be winners. Me? I don't want to be winners. I want to be a loser. I want to be the biggest loser. I mentioned that before, the biggest loser. to lose all the worry and fear of the past, to lose all anxiety for the future, to lose all your attachments, to lose all your thinking, to lose everything. How wonderful is that, to be free of possessions and concerns? And I know what that feels like. One of the first times I felt like that is just after 5 years as a monk. You had this wonderful opportunity in Thailand. At that time, I don't think you can even do it these days as well as you could do it in, this was 1979 or something, 1979-80. You know, I could speak Thai. I knew what I needed to do as a monk, how to get alms, food. And just with everything which I owned in the world, everything I owned, there was no money kept in any bank, I didn't have any money. There's no possessions stored with anybody. All my worldly possessions I carried on my back as I walked out of the monastery on what they called Tudong. In Sri Lanka they called it Charika. Just walking. I had my bowl, it was in a bag. I had spare robe. I had a water bottle, my mosquito net, an umbrella, and that was about it. A torch. It was so light. You know, when I see backpackers today, they've got so much stuff they carry with them. What I was carrying with them was hardly anything compared to backpackers these days. And the reason was because I didn't need anything. In Thailand at that time, it was idyllic. You could walk anywhere. And you could find any place to put your mosquito net and umbrella and sleep on the floor for the night. So many places you could go to, either in the paddy fields or in the forest, in the mountains, in the caves. And in the morning you go to the nearest village and you go on alms round. You'd always get some rice and maybe something to help with the rice. And no, that's me, something to go with the rice. You soon learned where to go and how to go. So I had this wonderful life of total freedom. Just your joy was your meditation. Your just precepts were your simplicity. And the freedom was immense. You had no place you had to go, nowhere you needed to be. You were like a bird, just flying through the sky, but I was grounded on the floor, on the paddy fields, the roads, the paths, through the jungles of Thailand. It's beautiful. And when you did that, you felt just hardly burdened at all in this world, when you had less. And I realized from that being a loser, someone who doesn't gain things but loses things, is one of the best ways in this world. Whenever you gain things and accumulate things, you have so many things you have to protect. When you lose things, it's like you have a freedom there. So on this weekend you've lost the ability to go here, to go there and do so many things. But don't look upon it as a loss of freedom when you go into lockdown. Look upon it as an increase in your freedom. You don't have to go out. You don't have to do things. You're at home, you can be peaceful, meditate, read the books you always put it off reading, catch up on your rest. If you're my age, have a bit more naps if you need to. And just enjoy the fact that you don't have to get things done in such a short, impossible length of time. You've got the whole weekend and also Monday. Monday's a public holiday here in Australia, so beautiful time of freedom. We've lost a lot. Well done. So I like that idea of being a loser, and especially when you become the biggest loser. And of course the biggest loser is, well, the statue of him is sitting behind me, the Buddha. Lost everything. So blissful, so lucky. We always think being a winner, is lucky. Somebody told me today that somebody won, I think it was $80 million in the lotto or something. They lived in New Zealand, said, oh, I lived in New Zealand. And they said, oh, you're so lucky you didn't win it. What do you mean, Ajahn Brahm? If you won the lottery, it'd have so much, it'd be such a burden, such a headache for you. A lot of people don't believe me, but it is. Losing things, being free, having nothing which you need, because you've got your friends and your family, your loved ones. That's a beautiful wealth which you have. That's why they used to say that people who were wealthy were people who wanted for nothing. I like that description of the ultimate wealthy people. Got so much money they want for nothing. So I realize from that description I'm incredibly wealthy. You want for nothing. Free! You can enjoy so much. So this is actually learning to look at things like lockdown, COVID, in a totally different way. And it just emphasizes the point that in life, life has got nothing to do, either your happiness, your wisdom, your growth, has got nothing to do with things or lack of things, but everything to do with the relationship you have with having many things or few things. In other words, lockdown or being able to go wherever you want, being in prison or being in a monastery or being in your home, how do you relate to that? Are you just upset that these things happen, or that they shouldn't happen or whatever? Is your relationship still one of thinking you can control these events in the world? If you don't realize that these events belong to nature, they can't be stopped, they can't be controlled, they're natural phenomena, pandemics or storms, tsunamis, volcanoes or whatever. Economies going up, economies going down. This is our nature, it's our world. We can't predict them. We can always have a beautiful relationship to these storms which happen in our life. Pandemics, lockdowns, tsunamis, tragedies, death. What is your relationship to life? I've learned, because I'm a monk, that whatever happens in life, you have this beautiful attitude of my door of my heart is open to life. No matter what you give me, no matter what you turn up, no matter what you present to me, the door of my heart is open to you. Lockdown, or meditation retreat, or having to go overseas to teach, or whatever happens, I open the door of my heart to what's happening. I don't close it and try and think of somebody to blame, of a place to escape, or thinking of all the rotten things which happen. And again, what comes up at a recent retreat, you know, for Thai people, I never said this story, but I remembered it and thought I could tell it, but didn't fit in at the time. But there was a story, I got the little book about it somewhere in Bodhinyana Monastery, about this monk, a very, very good senior monk, who was put in jail for 2 years. And they were wrongly sort of accused of being a communist. And at that time, being a communist, you know, you could get jailed for that. He was just an up-and-coming monk, very kind, very easygoing, very good meditator as well. And when he got put in jail for 2 years, he wrote a little story about it. He was found to be not guilty afterwards. And everyone was apologizing, oh, we shouldn't have done that, why did we do that to you, I'm sorry. What are you talking about, sorry? For 2 years, it was like being on a meditation retreat for 2 years. Now, how lucky is that? All I've ever managed to get here is 6 months retreat. That was pretty cool. That wasn't going to jail, by the way, that was in Bodhinyana Monastery. But 2 years on retreat. So he used that opportunity. He wasn't embarrassed or ashamed. He knew he hadn't done anything wrong. No one can make you feel embarrassed or ashamed, it's only you can. If you sometimes believe what other people say about you, or if you did make a mistake and you don't forgive yourself and learn from it quickly, that's where that sort of shame comes from. But he didn't have anything of that. He took the opportunities, because he was a bit of a scholar monk, to really catch up on the books he'd always meant to read but never got the chance to, because he was too busy. More meditation, more rest. He said it was the most wonderful time of his life. Not most wonderful, but I think a very good a time of his life. He never got angry for the people who sent him there. He felt so free. He had a really good relationship to what happens in life. Unexpected or expected, that's not the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is what you do with these weird, strange, unexpected events which come your way in life. For me, I still remember that time, it just comes to my mind, of just going to Perth Airport many years ago. I was supposed to give some talks throughout Indonesia. Starting off, I had to go through Bali, and then over the first talk was, in Yogyakarta. Unfortunately, when I got to the airport, there's a big queue on the check-in desk for, it was Garuda Airlines. And big queue there, and I was in the middle of the queue, or the bottom of the queue, and the announcement came up. Not the flight was delayed, but the flight was cancelled. And the next flight wouldn't go till the next day. So, oh my goodness, that means I won't be able to give my talk this evening. Yay, I can have an evening off. That's what I thought, I must admit. But it's a much better thought, because you couldn't change anything. You couldn't just make the airline get a flight or an aircraft from nowhere. So I remember just seeing all these passengers. I saw one in particular, this middle-aged businessman. And he was pounding on the desk with his fist, "You can't do this to me. I booked this flight. It's really important. I get here this day." Oh, I was just really overreacting. I felt so sorry for the poor flight attendant just working for Garuda Airlines who had to take all that rubbish from this angry man. Nothing she could do. It was only later on, of course, I realized what the cause was of the flight not arriving. No one could do anything about it. It was the time of bird flu. Garuda's a bird. So the aircraft must have got bird flu. Thank you for laughing. Because when you haven't got an audience, you can tell funny stories like that. And it's nice. Can we get some more laughter? Thank you. It gives me encouragement. But anyway, that's a much better response than a relationship to have to disappointments. Oh, you can go and give a talk there another time and give a bit extra the next time you go over there. You miss this one, but that's life. In other words, when life gives you, something unexpected, you can always make something of it and make something useful. And something I've noticed, whenever there's been lockdowns all over the world, why is it that when it's not lockdowns, people say, they've got money, they've got good job, but they're short of time. During lockdowns, now we've got time. Yay! Why are you complaining? You're an extra bit of holiday here. An extra time to relax and be at peace. Yay! I know there's one disciple follower who's going to drive myself and fellow monk, fellow Metaji, back to Bodhinyana this evening. Because we can't travel after midnight, otherwise the carriage turns into a pumpkin again, I think, or something like that. Something goes something like that, doesn't it? But anyway, I was just joking. I think it might be close to the truth that our driver this evening is kind of hoping that once he gets to Bodhinyana Monastery this evening, the lockdown is extended and extended and extended, so he could have more time. He's nodding his head,
so I can have more time at Bodhinyana Monastery for free. Yay, good old lockdown. We won't be able to travel afterwards. But anyway, see the positivity in some of the unexpected experiences in life. We know those unexpected experiences happen. You can't say they shouldn't, they mustn't, they oughtn't. They do. So what's your response to it? What's your relationship to it? Yeah, maybe you prefer it didn't have happened, but looking at the past and wishing it was different, that's where I got that word, ineffable. It's a transcendental word. That's what they used to call God, the ineffable. In other words, you can't describe, you can't know if it exists or doesn't exist. All these other things, ineffable. No, that's ineffable, sorry, I got it wrong again. The ineffable. Look it up in a dictionary, ineffable. Ineffable. I think it was Alan Watts who used to say, yes, you can't F truth. Truth is ineffable. Just making a funny story, but that was Alan Watts years ago. But anyway, I just said, let's make it more useful than just a joke and change the word to ineffable. You can't if the past. By that I mean you can't say if that whoever it was didn't get COVID, or if they hadn't travelled, or if there was more tests, or if I wasn't busy this weekend, or if. The past is ineffable. If I hadn't come to Perth, if my girlfriend hadn't dumped me when I was 19, I think I was at the time, hang on. I don't know what might have happened. It could have been worse, it could have been better, but what's the point of worrying about the past? If it could only just a little bit different, if it wasn't this way, it was that way. The past is unchangeable. It teaches us to accept it and let it go. The old acknowledge, forgive and let go of the whole of the past. The whole of our past. So I can be free from it. And here is this present moment. This is not bad. It's good enough. It's not perfect. But I can make something out of it. The relationship which I have to this moment, that's what's really important. So when you do that, then we can have a beautiful, happy life. So this is unexpected. Just having COVID lockdown this evening and the next couple of days, I don't know how long. But please don't allow negativity to come in. Make the most use of this time. Take a rest, take a bit of a break. Do some meditation, listen to some talks. You haven't done meditation before, get online. BSWA.org, there's so many free. Sorry, I got that wrong. So many priceless meditation teachings, and you can put some on, download them online for free, for priceless, at least for free, and just that they're valuable, but you don't pay anything for them at all, you don't need to, it's our gift to you, and take them and just listen to them and learn how to meditate and have a wonderful time. Change your attitude to life. When you change your attitude to life, whether it's lockdown or COVID-free, whether you're wealthy, whether you're poor, you have lots of things or few things. You have your friends and family. They're valuable. But even if you don't have those, you're like a monk. Free. A hermit at peace with the world and peace with your life and at peace with yourself. Make peace with your life this weekend. It's not that hard to do. Don't fight. Make love. With this moment, the door of my heart is open to you. Lockdown. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so see if we've got any questions. There won't be any questions from the floor because there's no people here, only a few. This is the staff. Hello, staff number one. Wow, seven questions.
First of all, in the UK, as a householder with a job and family, is the way to capture the essence of Tudong in your life? The essence of Tudong is this beautiful freedom of not carrying possessions. So what you can do as a householder with a job and family is not carry the past with you on your back. Most of the past is very, very heavy and creates such a burden for us to carry in life. Most of the past which we carry is a negative. All the time things went wrong. We hardly, honestly, we don't carry much happy memories of the past in our mind throughout the day. It's always the problems and the difficulties and stuff. So first, like, be like a Tudong husband, family member, householder, who's just left all the heavy negativity of the past behind you. It's also good actually to let go of the positive part of the past as well, in my opinion. And all of the fears of the future, what might happen, let that go. You don't know what may happen. So at least the past and the future, let that go. And any negativity, anger, resentment, revenge, guilt, anger, all that other stuff from the past, if you carry that around, that's really heavy. It means you can't dance through life. You can't jump and have joy and health and happiness because you're burdened with the pain of the past. Even though that pain lives in the past, you don't let it go. That's one thing you can do. And just do that much, oh, that's a lot. And anyway, you're not a householder. It's only temporary you're a householder. I don't know. Many of my friends, they got these, really worked hard, they got these really nice houses and just lots of rooms, and then their family sort of had the family and the family grew up. And once the family grew up and left, they didn't need such a big house anymore, so then they went smaller and smaller and smaller. Should have done that to begin with, have a small house. So little by little, your house gets smaller and smaller, and your last house, which you'll live in, it's about 6 foot long, 2 foot wide, maybe a foot and a half high, called your coffin. Remember that coffin, and please do not think outside of the box. The essence of Tudong life, simplify as much as you can. James in the United States, how do you deal with being in lockdown when you live in a household that isn't loving? Well, if you live in that household, make sure that you're loving. If other people don't love you, there's no reason you don't love them. Speak kind words to them. Speak beautiful. See how you can serve them and look after them. Sometimes when you don't live in a loving household, sometimes you blame others. But, you know, is there something you can do to make it more loving? Okay, here's one nice that I haven't told for a while. This, you know, one of the most unloving households you can possibly be in is called a jail. And so the first times I started teaching in prisons, I started talking like this. Well, just add some love and kindness into the place in which you live. And then some of the prisoners said, look, Ajahn Brahm, you're not realistic. You don't live in a place like a prison. This is a hard place. And that's when I asked them, I said, look, I don't agree with that. I asked them, I said, look, in this jail, I asked one of them, you know, I still know his name, it's Nick. He was a Greek, and I think he was in for drugs. I've got lots of stories about Nick. I really respected him because he did something with his life afterwards, and well done on him. But anyway, I had a little challenge. I said, who's the person in this jail who gives you the most anger and you're most resented to? And he just answered straight away. There was a senior prison officer. And Nick's job
was actually to serve him some tea and coffee or just look after his office, clean it up and stuff. And he said he really tried to be kind to this, what they call dog of a police, of a prison officer. That's what he called him, this dog. But this prison officer would not even acknowledge his existence. And so we had this test, the competition. And of course, you know who won the competition, because otherwise I wouldn't tell you in the story. But anyway, this, I asked him, look, when you get him a cup of tea or coffee, get him some biscuits or sandwiches or anything he can rustle up, and really put some love into that tea or coffee you're giving this man. He said, it won't work. I said, oh, come on, you know me, I've known you for a long time, and just give it a try. So every week I'd go there to teach, and I would ask him, how's it going? Hopeless. You know, I really go that extra effort for him to make the tea how he likes it and just get him something he likes to eat. But I just put it in front of him. Got some nice sandwich here for you, sir. He doesn't even say anything. He just totally ignores me. It's like he doesn't even see me, like I don't exist. Carry on. And I remember the time, it was a long time, about 3 months, if I remember correctly, when we got our breakthrough. And the breakthrough was he got some sort of special coffee from somewhere and just gave it to the prison officer and said, here you are, sir, I've got some really nice coffee for you today, sir, I got it from somewhere or other, I hope you like it. And the prison officer didn't look at him, but just said, just grunted. And that grunt was amazing. You know, he actually acknowledged a prisoner. And after that, this is, the wall is cracked, carry on, won't take long. And it didn't, about another month. And he got some biscuits or something, some special biscuits, you know, which the prison officer liked. And he gave, I got some really nice biscuits for you here today, so I hope you like them. And the prison officer turned around and said, thank you, to the prisoner. And I'm not sure about these days, but those days they said, West Australian prisons have a very strong grapevine. What happens even in Carnap Prison Farm will get known in Geraldton or the whole of the state or down in Albany. Not in Albany, they have it, where's that place just north of there where they have a prison? Anyway, the whole of the state soon found out about that and they couldn't believe it. All the prisoners said, that is unbelievable. That prison officer would actually say thank you to a prisoner. That's a true story. So, with kindness, it's worth it. You're in lockdown, you've got to stay there. Make the place a kind place. Be extra kind to the people who aren't loving. You put that seed in there. Not just COVID-19, but loving kindness. It's infectious. Marinya from Singapore, if you don't plan and don't expect anything, does it mean you just don't try and put effort anymore? Won't this cause inconvenience to other people around? Look at the amount of effort which I put into my life. Look at the talks which I do. Actually, no one's listening to it tonight, and I can't see anyone here. But that's only because of lockdown, but I'm sure many people listen to these talks. So there is something about not planning too much. So have plans, but make them out of rubber so they can bend very quickly. Because life gives you many opportunities. Plans stop you seeing those opportunities and taking them. It's the plans, which you only see the plans, what should be happening, what ought to be happening, not what is happening. It doesn't cause inconvenience for other people. It makes your life far more rich and beautiful and happy and successful. That's in my experience. Carmen, how do I cope with feeling of fear in the wake of civil war coming in this country? My worries for my future and for my family, can you please advise me? That may be, I'm not quite sure, there's many places in the world, maybe Myanmar. There may be sort of civil war coming in the country, but you know that if it is a place like Myanmar, caused a lot by the basically power-hungry senior military officers who are very afraid. Every one of those soldiers has mothers and sisters. Every one of those soldiers in places like Burma, if they can be softened, if they can be understood that they're firing against not just other Burmese, but they're firing against their sister, their children, their mum. How could you ever fire a bullet and the person in front of you is your mother? So, to mean that you're firing against people who are part of you, and to, it's not the generals who ever fire the bullets. For some reason, they brainwash, coerce people's children to shoot the bullets for them. There comes a time when the military just rebel, mutiny, whatever. They say, we're not going to do this anymore. Seeing that happening, yes, they see that happening in places like Thailand years ago. Was General Krengsak, I think it was, who refused to shoot on the protesters, and that just turned the government over. Maybe that might be a solution. The word gets around from the parents. Son, don't shoot. Anyway, the feeling of fear in the wake of civil war. Civil war, is it going to come? I'm not sure. But civil war doesn't last. I've seen in my lifetime, just in many countries, just like East Germany, Czechoslovakia in that time, the Eastern Bloc, the walls came down and we had some more freedom in the country. That's what people want. In the end, you can't refuse that. Julie, Ajahn Brahm, if we could define what it really means by judging people and things, what it is and what can we do to not judge anyone we meet? Army incident we encounter, thanks. To judging people. Have you ever tried to judge yourself? Are you a good person, a bad person? Why do you do things? Excuse me. So all judgments only see a part of what's happening. They're not thorough at all. That's one of the reasons why years and years ago I looked at any anger which came inside of me or resentment which came up inside of me. And I realized it's like a legal trial had happened inside my mind. The legal trial had somebody accused of some terrible thing which hurt me or hurt people I loved and cared for. When that person went on trial, in my mind, not a real court of law, but just in my mind, I was the prosecutor attorney, and I was also the judge. And so the prosecution laid down its case, and before the defense attorney had a chance to speak, I, the judge, slammed down the hammer and said, guilty. So they were considered to be guilty, and it justified my anger, so I thought. But when I look back upon that very unfair trial, I knew that when I was upset, I was actually looking for a guilty verdict. I wanted to judge them in the negative, and I had to force myself to have a defense attorney, no matter who it was, when they did something which upset me. I forced myself to find some extenuating circumstances to say, I don't know why they did that. Maybe they were just reacting because that's all they knew or because they'd been traumatized themselves when they were young. I couldn't prove that, but it gave the opportunity for me to come to what was called an open verdict. I couldn't judge them. And the same with even myself. Some of the things which I do and say, I can't judge me why I do things. And I try to do my very best, forgive, to learn, to grow. But I also realize that people aren't perfect in this world, that's why we're here. If we were perfect, we wouldn't be born in this human realm. We're here to grow, to learn, to become better. But to assume that people are always kind and good and they don't have ill will and stuff in this human realm, that's impossible. It's a learning place. Anyway, Charles. Dearest Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Chah encourages to maintain awareness in all postures and tasks throughout the day. This is easy when cooking or walking, but much harder when working on maths or analysis. The awareness only returns after the task is complete. How do we practice at work? He also advised us, and it's a much fuller description of how to be mindful in all postures, is whatever you're doing, give it everything you've got, 100%. And that was the story of that man from Sydney who came to see me because he needed to tell one of Ajahn Chah's disciples this. He hadn't been able to tell anybody that when he went to see Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand, it must have been only a year or two before Ajahn Chah passed away. Ajahn Chah was famous. And so he wanted to ask a couple of questions. He flew all the way from Sydney to Bangkok, Bangkok to Ubon, Ubon taxi to Warin Chamrap and Wat Bopong. That's where Ajahn Chah lived. And when he got there, he had the booking for the taxi to take him to the airport for the return flight to Bangkok and then back to Sydney. It was only to see Ajahn Chah, a very quick trip, that's all. And when he got there, he found there were so many people surrounding Ajahn Chah. He sat on the outside and after an hour or two, hadn't got any closer at all to the great monk. He was just too popular. So he gave up, disappointed, having gone all that way and not achieved anything. He started walking back, realizing now that his taxi would be another hour or so. So he got a broom and started sweeping, do something. I always remember that because of his kindness to do some good karma while he was waiting, to do some sweeping. Then he told me, up in the dining room of Bodhinyana Monastery, I remember him, he came and said that he felt a hand on his shoulder. He looked around and said, who's this? And the hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had seen him and decided to teach him something. And he got up from his seat, moved from the crowd encircling him, and put his hand on his shoulder and said the words which were translated, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then Ajahn Chah turned around and went home. Went over to another monastery, I think, another appointment. And the man realized that was coming from a very powerful monk. He thought about it on the flight home. When he got back to Sydney, when he went to work, he gave his work everything he had. When he was driving home, he gave driving everything he had. He wasn't thinking about work. When he was with his family, he gave his family everything he had. When he went to sleep, he gave sleep everything he had. When he was meditating, gave meditation everything he had. It's beautiful, in the present moment, giving it full attention, everything you've got. And he said his business flourished, his relationship with his family was amazing. And his meditation was getting pretty good. And he said it was just wonderful advice, not just being mindful in all postures for Charles, whoever asked this, when you are doing maths or analysis, give maths everything you've got. When you're doing analysis, give analysis everything you've got. Don't think of your family when you're doing the analysis. Don't think of sleep when you're doing analysis. Don't think of meditation when you're doing any of this. Whatever you're doing, give this full attention, everything you've got. And of course, you know the ending to this story, because I often say this story, whenever we have big fundraising, I say, when you go past the donation box, please remember, give it everything you've got. That's only a joke. And lastly, from Tunku, Ajahn Brahm, do you still get hay fever? How do you deal with it? Okay, I get sort of hay fever sometimes, but it's not that much. So I do have some, well, there's some sort of antihistamine, which I sometimes take, well, a lot of the time it's just a few sneezes, that's all. And sometimes that when you have the time for meditation, like there's not much hay fever around now, but every now and again you get a sneeze, it's not really a disturbance. That doesn't last that long. But every now and again during the hay fever season, which is usually, when is hay fever season? Get out, you know, October, November or something. You know one way I used to deal with my hay fever? I always tried to get overseas trips around that time. Because it only happened here in Western Australia. You go to Singapore, you go somewhere and your nose will be fine. But anyway, you know, when you can't go overseas, oh, it's okay, it's not a big deal. And sometimes when you meditate, oh, that's great, because you can go right inside your nose and calm everything down. And, you know, you don't, hay fever symptoms disappear then. It's really beautiful. What you can do with meditation is just boundless. Okay, so there we go for this evening's talk. I answered a few questions. Hope you all enjoyed it. And so I usually say, everyone says sadhu, but there's only 2, 4, 6 people here. So please, the 6 people here, or 7 with my fellow monk, loudest sadhus you can do to make it look good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. And now I usually pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha 3 times. And then that's it for this evening. So thank you. Apparently over 500 people watching online tonight. Thank you so much for watching. And I hope it was enjoyable and also helpful for you. And again, sorry you couldn't be here. I like sort of seeing people, but you can't. So I wish you all happiness and well-being and free from COVID. I hope this another lockdown doesn't last long.